Welcome to this podcast by the Heinrich Boll Foundation. It is part of the series called 50 Years of ASEAN, Still Waiting for Social and Ecological Justice. And this is your host, Johanna Son. In this episode, we examine the Haze Pollution Agreement of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which considers it a feather in its cap as it marks its fifth decade this year. The impact of ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, often feels hazy to many of its more than 620 million citizens. But the regional grouping's presence becomes very clear during the haze season, around August or so each year. After all, that is when a gray pall of polluted air usually envelopes parts of at least three ASEAN countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore, or more. News reports carry photos of people wearing masks, pollution indices soaring, and classes suspended because of the unhealthy air. What is life like when dusk lasts the whole day and there is a post-Armageddon feel to the world? Indonesian journalist Kanis Dursin recalls for us what the 2015 Haze episode, considered the worst to date, was like. At its height, the editor of the local Arua tabloid was in central Kalimantan, where most of the forest fires and burning of peatland was occurring.
People were wearing masks when they go out of their houses. Motorists have to wear masks also and have to put on their emergency lights because the visibility was very, very limited. The visibility was only 1 kilometer. Students were still going to school and people were still going to work, but they have to wear masks. I remember also one time my flight was delayed and we cannot land. We have to fly, you know, over Pontianak city for 30 minutes. Our plane could not land because of the haze.
Before 2015, the worst episode of transboundary haze pollution took place in 1997. That was, in fact, what drove ASEAN to take action on this cross-border challenge. To this date, its response to the haze problem remains among the toughest that ASEAN has taken on its too long list of concerns. For Mo Tuzar of the ASEAN Studies Center in Singapore, haze was nothing short of scary. As the lead researcher for social cultural issues for the center, she handles environmental issues.
What was like so scary, if I could use that word, was the way that the haze just enveloped everything. I happened to be in Singapore for my graduation, and we were outside on the road at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was just like a very heavy, thick mist had fallen and visibility basically dropped to almost zero. So you couldn't really see that far ahead in front of you. And it was not just a mist. It was also the very, very thick smell of smoke. So a lot of people who had respiratory problems had to not only stay indoors, but to stay in bathtubs and basically be in a moist environment that helped them breathe and so on. And so, yes, for everyday business, I think in Singapore, everything stopped.
The haze bugs Southeast Asia yearly to this day. But ASEAN has had, since 2002, a governance mechanism consisting of a mix of regional as well as national commitments and actions to ease its impact on public health and safety and daily life, as well as economic costs. On ASEAN's 50th year, we take a closer look at the ASEAN Agreement on Transboundary Haze Pollution, which Southeast Asia's main regional grouping considers one of its successes. In this episode, we discuss its impact as a tool for environmental governance and its legacy in shaping the ASEAN way of managing regional problems. The Haze Treaty was signed by ASEAN's 10 member countries 14 years ago and entered into force in 2003. It requires parties to enlist concerted national and joint efforts and intensify regional and international cooperation in the management of forest fires. It also commits them to undertake legislative and administrative measures to prevent and control activities related to such fires. All of these made up ASEAN's response to the haze in its midst, Mo Tuzar explains.
If we look back at what catalyzed maybe new, perhaps more effective ways of dealing with it, as well as innovative ways of making sure that coordination happens across sectors, across borders, and within countries, across departments, down to the local level. I would say the Hays experience really catalyzed some of these moves. So we're very used to now all these in-country coordinations and so on. But there was a time in ASEAN not so long ago that these were still very new ways of working together. So yes, in that context, I would put the Hays as one of the catalyzing points for the way ASEAN now tries to really work more effectively. And the growing awareness, the growing consciousness that whatever is agreed to regionally requires national implementation, and that is the responsibility of the member states.
In ASEAN terms, and this is an organization not always known for its swiftness of response or boldness of political will, its member states have made the Hays problem the highest priority, both as a regional challenge and an environmental concern. The Hays drove ASEAN to create and use special venues to address it. In the late 90s, its environment ministers held special meetings about it. National focal points were set up within countries. Cooperation was sought with institutions like the Asian Development Bank to boost member states' technical capacities. A special unit that focuses only on Hays exists in the ASEAN Secretariat, which is based in Jakarta. In other words, deciding to have a Hays agreement that constituted an internationally binding commitment was no small measure. In fact, the Hays Treaty is the first legally binding agreement on the environment among ASEAN's 10 members. Motu Zahar describes a special place that Hays occupies in the ASEAN organization.
Hays has always had that kind of special distinction in having a focused ministerial meeting, plus a focused desk to really monitor it, plus these active Hays action online networks, monitoring the hotspots, as well as the triggering mechanisms in place to activate the sub-regional or the in-country communications and networks in case of an incident occurring. So I would see these as both the gains and the impacts. In terms of ASEAN really gearing up to deal with a focused issue, that when it happens has an intense impact on the populations that are affected by it. But after, say, the situation dies down, somehow, it doesn't go away from people's consciousness. The mechanisms are there for the next occurrence.
But the Hays is not only about the environment, but about economics and managing competing interests, as well as foreign policy. For years, this recurring problem was an irritant in ASEAN's relations with Indonesia. Mainly, the forest fires there raged due to land clearing to make way for planting palm oil, of which the country is the biggest producer of. Indonesia was the last ASEAN country to ratify the treaty in October 2014, 12 years after it was signed. The long period it took Indonesia, long a senior player in ASEAN, to ratify the Hays Treaty reflects the juggling act that the country needs to make as it shapes its development path. The political and economic realities that played out included the tussle between environmental and foreign policy concerns and economic gains from clearing land, between national policies and a decentralized political structure, and between regional versus local interests. The regional decision that committed individual ASEAN countries to address causes of the fires and comply with international law on the matter was not exactly a politically palatable one among Indonesians. A helping hand from friendly neighbors was not always seen as such, recalls Kanis Dursin. Was this the case even if it was ASEAN that was involved?
Yes, because until we ratified the agreement, the ASEAN sentiment was not that strong in Indonesia. People were still very much looking inward, looking into themselves, then, regionally, looking into ASEAN. Even when the ASEAN community was announced, it would take into effect, people will say, oh, what is ASEAN? But so all issues, all foreign helps in this case, in the forest fires case, they would see it as a foreign country intervening in domestic affairs. They say they can do it, but the fact is they could not. The forest fires have been there for quite some time. And they have resisted the helps from ASEAN countries. Things have changed now. People are more open. Politicians are also more open to fellow ASEAN countries to help Indonesia.
Looking back, Motuzar points out that Indonesia knew that it was by no means out of the Hague Treaty's ambit, even if its parliament had not yet ratified it.
I think the thing about all ASEAN agreements, whether or not they are legally binding, is this important element of being morally binding. The fact that you're an ASEAN member and you've signed on to this, you've adopted this, even if you haven't squared away the ratification at the national level, there is some kind of moral obligation. And I think this is something that was felt very much, at least in Jakarta, at least at the central level. But there were clearly domestic issues and interests at play there that held up the ratification process in Indonesia, in Indonesia's parliament, I should say, until 2014. And even then, what was ratified at the parliament needs to be translated into practical implementation guidelines down at the local level, which is something that I think Indonesia is still sorting out.
In May 2015, the Indonesian government of President Joko Widodo extended the moratorium on forest clearing for land conversions as a way to control forest fires behind the Hague. These days, Kanis Tursin explains, the average Indonesian recognizes that taking steps to help fix the Hague problem domestically is in their interest and not only that of the Southeast Asian community.
At the local level, people have long called for an end to land conversion. At the local level, you know, those companies in the palm oil industry are seizing local land, people of the land of the local people. They just take over and then expel, local communities. And those local communities have long called for the government to end, to at least to stop the land conversion. So when the government decided to extend the moratorium, to introduce and extend the moratorium, people welcome it very much. They like it very much. I mean, they would say they said, I mean, finally the government listens to them.
After all, the locals suffer the most from the effects of the Hague in their midst. The Hague challenge has also brought other benefits to ASEAN's development as a regional organization and looking ahead as a community as well. First, it provided ASEAN a laboratory of sorts to develop a regional, sustained response and a governance mechanism for a problem that involves both short-term emergency needs and long-term action, and one that has been useful to its management of other crises. The core of ASEAN's Hague management approach has been its linking of regional commitment and national implementation, Motuzar stresses.
That had the kind of a knock-on implementation effects in other areas that also require very focused and very intense coordination when the situation is happening, for example, disasters. The Hague Action Network that emerged out of all of that, essentially linking up the national focal agencies virtually, online, and also through video conferencing, became something that ASEAN fell back on for future such quote-unquote crisis situations like, say, the Disaster Management Action Network, as well as the kind of consultations that the relevant officials and other sectors had to do with regard to SARS and later avian flu.
Second, ASEAN's Hague experience may have provided a shared experience crucial to its member states' forging of a stronger community feeling. This is important given the fact that on its fifth decade, ASEAN is pursuing its goal of becoming a community of 10 member states and its peoples. Increasingly, Indonesians are seeing that regional and domestic interests do not have to clash, says Kanis Tursin.
Indonesians begin to realize that we can count on ASEAN countries. But before it was difficult. As I said, people did not have that, you know, vision about ASEAN. In fact, I mean, if you go to local people, they don't think about Indonesia. They always think about, you know, their ethnic groups. They think about their islands. That has changed. since the government, you know, started campaigning the ASEAN community, what is the implication of the ASEAN community, and also some ASEAN countries help Indonesia in the fight against haste. Things have changed slowly that people, oh yes, ASEAN countries can help us. Even now, when people can now think like, oh, people, we, Indonesians can go to other countries to sell their goods. That awareness is growing now. But until 2 or 3 years ago, that awareness was very limited to, you know, government officials and some activists, not at the grassroots level.
In fact, among the ASEAN community's goals are a haze-free ASEAN by 2020. Indonesia, meantime, has promised its neighbors that there will be no haze crisis in 2017, according to news reports. For the ASEAN citizen, the haze headache has highlighted the very concrete link between foreign policy, environmental governance, and everyday life. As the ASEAN Studies Center's Motuzar says,
it was something that hits the populace at large. And of course, people on the street, your normal man on the street, ordinary folk, won't know about ASEAN mechanisms. All they know is that this haze is affecting how I go about my daily life and what our government's doing about it and who's responsible. Why can't we go after the culprit? So really, sometimes it also boils down to that kind of bottom-up effect that catalyzed regional actions.